as we acknowledge gender fluidity, and indeed sexual fluidity, there's a letter in the LGBTQI plus alphabet soup that is, according to my next guest, less accepted. It's the I for intersex, which is truly non-binary, and it's Michaela Cahill's story. And indeed, according to the United Nations, the story of 1.7% maybe of the world's population. Michaela Cahill was born intersex, but at the age of 23, had her testes surgically removed, something she now regrets. She's now 26, she's a paralegal, and she's with me now. Kia ora, Michaela.
Kia ora, Kim. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Now, I'm calling you she. I do not know which pronoun you prefer, actually.
I identify as non-binary, but I use she, her pronoun, so all she right. is more than fine.
It becomes complicated, doesn't it? Because I found myself when I was reading that, I'm going, oh, I'm they. What? Thank you for talking about something so personal. You were born with a condition called complete androgen insensitivity syndrome, or CAIS. Can you explain what that means?
Sure. In a nutshell, CAIS is essentially a person whose body is not responsive to androgens, which make the testosterone essentially have the effect and the masculine effect that they do on bodies. Because I had undescended testes in my abdomen that produced testosterone that my body was irreceptive to processing, it naturally converted it to estrogen, and that's why I have XY chromosomes and no female reproductive system internally, but have a female body on the outside.
And when was this discovered? I mean, when did you first realize this?
My mother knew about it before I was 1 year old because of the hernias that I got as a baby. I didn't find out properly until I was 15 years old. When I was 11, I found out that I wouldn't get my period or be able to have children, but I didn't exactly know why. And when I was 15, I was called in to an appointment at the pediatric ward in Christchurch Hospital, and my specialist at the time called me in and sat me down, and he said, "You were meant to be born a boy. You don't have a womb."
You were meant to be born a boy.
Those were his exact words.
And what was your response to that?
I completely disassociated. I remember him drawing the diagrams of female internal reproductive systems and then kind of like the outline of a female body and like a circle that represented a hollow mass that was what was inside my body. And I remember him talking to my mother and them having a really good in-depth discussion. Because he was the first doctor that I think was able to properly medically tell her, you know, what my body was like. But I just completely disassociated, and I didn't realize that's what it was at the time. But looking back, it was very strong.
Did you always, throughout your childhood and youth until, I don't know, whenever, identify as female?
Yes. I always felt female, even though chromosomally I'm not. I always felt like a woman. I was raised like a woman. I was raised very girly. I always liked and naturally gravitated towards very girly things, which I still do. And one thing I find really interesting is that I say all the time, I never felt intersex until all of the medical and surgical intervention.
So 2 or 3 years ago, your testes, your undescended testes, were surgically removed on the advice, and this is quite common advice, I think, under these situations, that they were a cancer risk because if they're undescended, they are kept at a warmer temperature. And there were also the hernias that you mentioned. Do you believe now that that was the wrong advice for you?
Oh, that is a very good question. And that is a question that hasn't been framed like that before. And I'm really excited to answer it. I think it's quite difficult to say because CAIS is different for everybody that has it, obviously. My experience is not going to be representative of everyone that has it because people aren't monoliths. But one thing that I would say is that I was told flat out that I had a 30 to 35% risk of cancer, whereas the medical research over the last 20 years, from what I've seen anyway, shows it to be anywhere ranging from 0.8 to 30% at a maximum. I was told by the head of the female multidisciplinary clinic in Green Lane Hospital in Auckland last year that the risk of me contracting cancer was actually only closer to 5%, and that I had a 95% chance of not developing that cancer, but that they would still recommend the surgery as a precaution to remove the cancer risk. One thing I think is really interesting, however, is that when it comes to breast cancer or testicular cancer in typical males and females, doctors don't just recommend that you cut off their organs because they might potentially become cancerous when they're older. They get offered biopsies, they get offered constant monitoring, they get offered really good medical support. And I don't understand why that is not in place for the intersex community, because if people can get biopsies on all other types of their bodies to look at cancers and to look at malignancy and make sure it's there before they have these really invasive and very heavy surgical procedures, why is that not a system in place for intersex people?
So your suspicion would be that it is not so much on the grounds of the health risk, but on the grounds of normalisation that the testes are removed.
100%. And I think it's also really important to remember here that the medical model for treating intersex people was designed by the studies and research made by John Money in the mid-20th century. He lied flat outright to the hospitals and the medical professionals that picked this up as a good model. His personalised research and his notes constantly document how it's not working and he doesn't know what to do. But he lied because he wanted to continue the vein of his successes, even though it was farcical. And I think this is what has caused the problem, is that lie has been misconceived as truthful fact for what is good for intersex people. And especially as we develop into this cultural shift of gender knowledge and sexuality knowledge and queer knowledge and acceptance within society, there is still a really big barrier between what doctors assume of intersex people and how they treat them, not understanding all of those complex nuances.
Can you elaborate? What was John Money's lie?
So John Money's lie was around the story of David Reimer. David Reimer was an individual in the United States who, after a circumcision, had been left with deformed and unrecognized genitalia. His parents didn't know what to do, and they saw Dr. Money talking about sexual reassignment surgery. His theory was essentially nurture over nature in terms of gender, which inherently in and of itself is not wrong, because we know that gender is a social construct. It is very much about nurturing how you identify. The problem with his model is that he said in order for the nurture to be effective and to take place and for the identity to form properly and stay, the child has to identify between their gender identity and their genitalia. He performed these sex reassignment surgeries on David Reimer, who then became Brenda, was raised as a woman but never felt like a woman. In adolescence, the parents told him what had happened. He then had sex reassignment surgery to become a man and was so traumatized at the age of 38, he shot himself and committed suicide. The entire time, while John Money was saying to the medical community, this case has been a success, Brenda is a very happy heterosexual woman, he was having constant follow-ups with David Reimer and at the time his twin brother. And one of the sessions forced them to reenact heterosexual copulation as a way to inform and solidify the gender roles and identities that they were meant to develop. But in his research, he notes constantly how this wasn't working, how how Brenda was not identifying as a woman. And one of his journals also talks about how it's important for the process of medicalization and diagnosis and treatment and the Family Institute to pathologize and medicalize the child with language as an insurance of stopping childish claims of maiming and torture against the child for surgical intervention.
It is indeed a terrible story, but John Money's basic argument was that children need a stable gender identity. Do you think that that's not true, or do you just object to the way in which it is enforced, if I can put it that way?
Yeah, I think children have a stable gender identity, even if it's not the one that their parents might want them to have. Children know who they are a lot of the time. You know, they are children. They will always need guidance as they develop their critical thinking skills. We all do. And it should continue right through until, you know, we go kaput. That's what makes critical thinking so great. But I think when we talk about John Money and his ideas, I think it was very much a forced concept of heterosexual gender identity in a society at the time that had no acceptance of homosexual people, of lesbian people, of transgender people. And I think going forward, it's really important that we acknowledge that that is a large group of society that exists and has a really large amount of mental health issues and psychological issues and social stigmatization. I definitely would say that I object to the way in which Money tried to enforce his nurture over nature theory. I think that this conversation is probably too complex to really get a straight answer to that question in such a limited amount of time, but I do object to the way that it's been enforced.
The United States, Michaela, has just issued the first third gender option passport, and it denotes with an X for non-binary, intersex, and gender non-conforming US citizens. I'm wondering if you think that that should be what's done generally. Do you want intersex as a third option?
There are many intersex people that identify their sex as intersex, and there are also many intersex people that identify their sex as an intersex female or intersex male.
Right.
I think a better way for all of this stuff on birth certificates and marriage certificates and passports would be to have both sex classification and gender identity, because I think constantly a lot of the problems that we see around that is a conflation between sex and gender, which are different both biologically and sociologically and culturally and psychologically. And I think that it's really important that we also understand that, you know, intersex is an umbrella term made up of upwards of 70 different health variations in sex characteristics. So there are intersex people who feel that their biological sex is intersex because they had ambiguous genitalia when they were born and potentially still do if they were able to evade surgery. But there are also intersex people that are relatively typical but have small variations that cause minor health issues, and so they don't necessarily identify themselves as just purely intersex. And I think if we were to have intersex as a third sex option for passports, as well as gender identity markers on passports, so that someone could say, I'm male, but I identify as a woman, because women and female are different to each other.
There seems to be a thing at the moment for a lot of young people to believe themselves transgender and to actually want the treatment to enable them to become the gender that they have not identified with. There's a certain amount of controversy about that. Do you think that what you've just said would mean that one could biologically be male, identify as female, or vice versa, and not need surgical or hormonal intervention? I don't know how to frame that question less clumsily, but do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do know what you mean. I think it's important to state that regardless of anyone's opinions about transness that isn't trans, trans people are trans people and we have to accept them, and they know what they need more than anyone else. I also think it's important to remember that there are many trans people that don't physically transition. There are, trans is a very large, wide-arching gender identity that also encompasses other gender identities such as non-binary and gender fluid and gender queer as well. It's not just so straightforward and polarizing as the type of trans that we're often discoursing and debating about. But I would say that regardless of what I said before in terms of having sex and gender on birth certificates or passports, which are different from each other and do have different health needs, if you are anatomically male and have XY chromosomes in a male body, you will need different healthcare to someone with a female body, but that does not make you any less of a woman if you identify and feel as a woman, because gender and sex are different from each other.
Somebody suggests, a listener suggests, that official documents like passport and birth certificates could be made less complicated by removing the gender, sex box altogether. Do you think that that would be useful?
I mean, I don't see why not. I understand why it's been there so far, but, you know, we are in a very advanced society and there is always a question of, are the old models or old ways of doing things necessarily working, or do they need to be in place? I do think, though, that if you get into that debate, you also have to take into consideration, like, international relationships. You have to take into the sociocultural and sociopsychological understandings of gender minorities and queer minorities in other countries that don't particularly have the best acceptance of queer people. For example, I think doing that in Ghana could be potentially really dangerous. But at the same time, I'm a Pākehā person who lives in New Zealand, so my opinions on that in terms of international relations aren't really that important. It's definitely something that the world should consider, though, because I think if you categorise and binarise people too much, it just inherently creates a lot of problems.
How are you feeling now? I mean, I presume because you would have got female hormones as well from those testes, and so you'll be on hormone replacement therapy, will you?
Yes, I'm on Progynova. I'm on 2 milligrams of Progynova daily, 3 milligrams of Progynova every second day. Prior to Progynova, I was on the estradiol patch of about 100 or 75 micrograms every 3 days to 3.5 days. When I was in the consultation process for my surgery, I explicitly asked my specialist in Dunedin about what hormone replacement therapy options would be good for me. I asked him about Progynova, which was the pill, as I was on antidepressants at the time, and I knew that it would be really good for me to just take them at the same time. And I was flat out told no. That is not safe. The patch is safer, and that is what we're going to try you on. And it wasn't until I had a breakdown in ED for an unrelated health issue last year when a doctor asked me, why are you on hormone replacement therapy at such a young age? That must be really hard. That a lot of the trauma and psychological disassociation from my body that I experienced as a result of my orchidectomy and as a result of being induced into menopause hit me. And that's when I got a referral to the FMC, and after 3 months got seen by an endocrinologist here in Auckland who said that I could go on Progynova if it was the only way that I would take my hormones, which was, because I just flat out stopped taking the patch because it made me feel awful.
I believe that the Intersex Trust Aotearoa New Zealand, which was established by Marnie Mitchell, has the view that being intersex is not something that needs to be fixed. You're in agreement with that position, huh?
I am. As a board member of ITANS myself, I'm very much within that position. Intersex people are born very healthy and very normal. There are sometimes, you know, life-threatening reasons that children that are born need surgery. And intersex advocates and activists are not saying that surgeries should stop. We are saying that the model should be built around protecting and caring and affirming the intersex children and, like, deferring all and any surgical intervention until they are of age where they can consent fully and are given the information that they need to give fully informed consent. When I had my surgery at the age of 23 as a master's student, I was not given medical research. I was not given the name of the type of cancer I would be exposed to. I was not given any information or support resources.
Yeah, that's a hole in the system. I appreciate your time. Thank you, Michaela Cahill.